It is wonderful, as always, to be here with you. So my subject this morning actually kind of began as an assignment. I was asked to explore the topic of vocation for First UU. It's their theme for this month. So when I get assigned a topic, I typically go to history and I go to the dictionary. So I started looking things up in the dictionary, which probably won't surprise some of you, and looked through medieval history, which is one of my favorite places. And here's what I started thinking about vocation. You're kind of thinking, how are we going to get to being ourselves from vocation? Well, we kind of inherited, I think, a troublesome word and a troublesome history around the idea of vocation. When you look up vocation in the dictionary, you find that it has two definitions. And one is a divine call to priestly work or something like that. Okay, so there's this idea of a call from outside, from God traditionally, to the work of ministry. And then there is also a special urge or inclination toward a particular work, or also a specified occupation, profession, or trade. And when I read that, I think vocational school, which I don't know that anybody uses that anymore, but it was very common to talk about vocational education when I was a kid. So you have two very kind of almost separate senses of the word vocation here. One is sort of a calling to be set apart, and the other is a calling to a particular trade in the world, a particular occupation. When you look at the etymology of the word, where the word comes from linguistically, vocation comes through French from Latin. And it comes from the word vocare, or if you're a purist about Latin pronunciation, vocare. But I want you to be able to find it in a dictionary. And it starts with a V, so vocare. It's a dead language, right? And vocare is the verb to call. It's also the same root that we get words for voice and vocal, those words, that whole. So vocation, the word, comes from something that does include this sense of call, something that is heard, right? Something that is vocalized. In the medieval history, and I want to say sort of classic medieval history, like not medieval people, but the people who first sort of described medieval society and how it works, there is this idea of the three estates. And I want to make sure you understand, as simple as this, but there are three estates, and if you are a human being, you belong to one of them. That's sort of the oversimplified, because of course women are kind of odd. You're not, I'm not sure they were sure that women were people back then. But the three estates, there are those who pray, those who fight, and those who work. Okay? So those who pray are the church, the clergy. Those are the people who have a special vocation, right? Then there are those who fight, and that's the nobility, the class of people descended from the earliest knights. Okay? Those, they fight. And then there are those who work. That's the rest of us, poor schlumps. You know, we're the people who work. And it turns out that, like, basically the prayers get to establish moral codes, and the fighters get to establish what everybody has to do. They make the laws and enforce them because they have the, you know, just the raw power and weaponry to enforce how things should be. And then there's the people who feed everyone, who pay taxes, who enrich the coffers of the nobility and the church. And you are born into one of these. And you might, there's a little bit of mobility, and it changes over European history. But there is this sense that there are three main roles that people can have in life. You can pray, you can fight, or you can work. So this led me, you know, back to the dictionary. I'm looking up work. And work is, well, in physics, it's force plus distance. And some of you here will like that. That's physics. It's defined in modern English as effort, physical or mental, to make or to do something. And then you start drilling down through more definitions and the etymology. And historically, you see that work is something other than being noble or being genteel. Certainly different from praying, right? Although our definition doesn't exclude those kinds of activities, work especially has come to denote labor. And that was really strong in the Middle Ages, but also well into modern Europe. If you read 19th century novels, you see a lot of this kind of thing. There are people who are sort of the genteel poor, and they would rather live in poverty than go out and earn wages by working. That's, you know, to work for pay, to labor, is less than somehow than being noble. And so I sort of drifted on from the definition of work in the dictionary to labor. And labor is hard or fatiguing work. Okay. Oh, by the way, it's also childbirth. Then from labor, I drifted over to the word menial. And this is where I got mad. So menial work is defined as work that is not requiring much skill and lacking in prestige. And there you kind of go, huh. Clearly we have this idea ingrained in our language and how we use it, that some kinds of work are less than other kinds of work. Right? Some ways to spend your time are less worthy, less admirable, less worth seeking out and following than other ways. And that's problematic. And then I looked at the etymology. This is where the word comes from. It comes into English from French, and it comes from a word that means household. And the first uses of the word menial in English were as a noun for household laborers. Okay, I'm a feminist. And I just got really mad. It's like, oh, shoot, yet again, and rooted centuries back in how we use the English language, is this idea that the work that women do, the work, and it's men too, it's not just women, but the work that is done to create a home that people live in is not as worthwhile. And we assume it does not require skills that other more valuable and worthy kinds of work require. And so to me, it's obvious that this is kind of problematic. I had also recently, before I found this in the dictionary, heard from my son, who's in college and going to programs and things with other young liberal people. And he reported to me a conversation he had about menial work with another young man his age. And the drift of the conversation was that progressive thought needs to be all about removing the onerous menial labor that is part of human life now from everyone. We will be free, we will find equity when no one has to do menial labor anymore. The robots will take it all over. And when my son tried to say, well, but there's a certain satisfaction in doing some of this work. Yeah, he happens actually to have a work-study job in the athletic department laundry. And he's like, you know, but it's good to have something that needs to be done, and you do it, and then it's done, and then somebody is happy enough about that to pay for it. Actually, those are my words, not his. But he was going along this track, and he was told, no, that's just not acceptable. That's actually, it was labeled slave talk. You know, slavery, it the kind of thinking that reinforced slavery and was used to justify slavery, which was not at all what he was trying to say. And I think I'm troubled by this idea that if we just automate all the hard stuff in our lives, we'll all be freer. One, I don't know how we're never going to automate that childbirth thing. It's not going to work. But also, So I'm a human being. I live in a body. My skin sheds off in these little flakes, and it makes dust. And the dust has to get vacuumed up. And yes, we can make a Roomba, or now they have other brands, so I guess I shouldn't, you know, we should come up with a generic word, that will go ahead and vacuum all that dust up. And that's not a bad thing, but I wonder if the extent to which I can automate all those consequences of living in a body doesn't kind of limit what I know about what it is to be human. I don't think the fact that I have skin that sheds and makes dust and creates something that needs to be swept out the door is just incidental. I think that is, it's part of who I am. And to try to get rid of the consequences of living in bodies, I think somehow limits how well we know ourselves. And I don't know if that makes sense to anybody. I haven't developed this much further than that. I just have this deep intuition that we live too far away from our own bodies. And talking about menial labor as something negative pushes us further and further away. So I have this list of things that I find problematic about the legacy of the idea of work and vocation that we've inherited. First, this equation of vocation with priestly or ministerial paths, career tracks, life tracks, or being set apart in some special way. Even when it's expanded, because in the Reformation, both Protestant and the Catholic Reformations in Western Europe, that idea of vocation was explicitly expanded to include other ways of life. So some people have a vocation, a calling to the ministry, but marriage can be a calling too. And there were several others. So still, there is this sense that there's a little bit of your life that might be sacred, the being married, but it's not so much about your work, unless you're a priest. So somehow then the priests get to be really special again still. The ministers do. So I'm a little worried about that. Also the idea that some work is valued more than others, and I don't think there's any denying that our culture at large tends to think that way, even though there have been many, many voices over the years that have tried to insist upon the dignity of work and the dignity of all possible work. We still see, and I think that word menial coming from the word for household the way it does just kind of underlies how very old that tendency to see some work as less than, less skilled, less important, less valuable. Kind of, it still is with us very much. And then we have this idea of vocation, some ideas of vocation as call, especially when that call is envisioned as coming from an external source. We tend to get this idea of vocation as something that's static from outside myself and requiring obedience or not, or, you know, you have choice. You can answer it or you can disobey it. And that I find kind of narrow, and I'll come back to that. Then we also have this idea of a sense of self that's separate from the work we do that I think comes down in all these ways that we think about labor and work and vocation. And it's odd to me because I also am seeing that our self-worth in this culture is often very much tied to the type of work we do. So you're kind of in a just can't win situation. And finally, my very last quibble with our inherited sense of vocation is that we see it as private and individual. So vocation, in all these ways of talking, is about what I do, or what you do, or what she does, him individually, what that person does, and not about, I find it lacking in the context of interconnection that I think is always important to hold on to. There are, however, some things about the idea of vocation that I like. And this is why, you know, churches choose it as a theme for the month or for a top, you know, for a sermon at least. Menial, we could choose to redefine it. We could go back to the very old meaning of the household, and we could say household work is important. Household work is something everybody needs to worry about. And there are movements in our culture that do that. There's also this idea of call. And I love what, I think I've mentioned this book before here, but if I haven't, it's one of my favorites. This is Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker activist and teacher and writer. He has a book called Let Your Life Speak that I just love. But he talks about answering our lives, listening for that voice of our lives, and not from the outside in, which is where I think the traditional ideas of vocation is what I should do with my life, is about listening for something from outside, looking for role models or really high purpose and ideals and building a life, you know, focused on forcing that to happen for me to fit that mold. He contrasts that with a sense of call from within. An inside out. It's not disconnected from the world at all, but it involves listening to who you are and what your life says to you about the values that you should be embodying. Instead of picking, you know, values, there's lots of good ones. You know, it's like me saying, so which of the seven principles, the seven UU principles we recited earlier, which one is the most important to you? So just do that one. Just skip it all. And Parker Palmer says, you know, that's sort of outside in. So where is your life speak to you? Where is your center? And how do you bring that into the world? And I think when we do that, when we build a vocation, a life, a sense of answering something, responding to something. And this is where I like the word vocation in the sense of call, because it does ask us to respond. And I do think in creating a life and a life that expresses who we truly are, our true selves, and how we live that world, we do have to make choices. We have to answer something, but we choose. And we often have to choose not to do other good things. And it requires a certain kind of focus. And it can be a discipline. It's, I think, part of what spiritual disciplines help us to do better. Well, all sorts of spiritual disciplines help us to hear our own inside self so that we can make good choices about how we spend our energy outside. And the other thing I really do like about the three estates, much as you can sort of do stereotypical, you can imagine all sorts of little caricatures of the medieval three estates that are laughable or very, very sad or inspire anger and rebellion. But there's also a sense in which they do emphasize the embeddedness of the individual in their culture, in their society, in their family, in their town. And that's something in our culture that I think we often lose. Although, to me, it seems we're all of us, swinging more back to understanding the webs in which we live. So the challenge for us as UUs, as people who seek to understand what we value most and how we can make more of it in the world, is to figure out, so what should I be doing? And my experience has been that it just takes a long time to figure that out. And even if you think you figured it, actually, you know, sometimes you know really early, and it still takes a long time to figure out how what you know comes out in the world and happens. And so I think it's always just fine. It's better than just fine. It's important to be exploring and testing out ideas and interests, to be choosing not to do different things. Maybe you'll do them next season. I think we have to be careful not to get endlessly distracted from who we are. And sometimes it's helpful, I think, to come back to maybe a touchstone. And I think we all have to pick our own. But for instance, the question that interests me right now, Adrienne Marie Brown in her book Emergent Strategy says, so what are human beings for? I think that's a really interesting question. She talks first about dandelions. Dandelions are healers, and they're really good at turning from flowers into seeds and blowing away really quickly. They are not just healers, they are spreaders of healing far and wide. You know, a single dandelion apparently can propagate really far, those little seeds floating off. So dandelions are for healing. She talks about mushrooms. Mushrooms are for detoxing. They screen impurities out of the soil. So what are human beings for? And her answer to that question is to suggest that maybe human beings are for love. Maybe our purpose here is to love. And she thinks when we are living in love or out of love, we're better. We're more true to ourselves. The quality of attention we pay to the people around us is different. And so she finds that compelling, that answer to the question. Other people have other answers. I have found many UUs, and especially, and not just Unitarian Universalists, but also people who tend to be engaged in science. What we're for, I think, perhaps it's curiosity, but I think even deeper than that, it's wonder. And it's this, oh my God, it's kind of the, oh, mushrooms do that? Oh, you know, maybe that's what we're for. Maybe it's wonder. The purpose, the thing we can do as human beings is to wonder about things and to encounter things and respond with an attitude of awe. Maybe that's who we are on this planet. Or Robin Wall Kimmerer in the book Braiding Sweetgrass suggests, and this is coming from the perspective of different culture, indigenous cultures, indigenous to this continent, she suggests that a lot of those cultures are very clear that what human beings are for is gratitude. And they have cosmologies in which every single creature and the plants, every different kind of berry, every different kind of bird, every tree, every part of creation has a purpose. And it's a purpose that serves the whole. And in these cultures, Kimmerer says, human beings' purpose is gratitude. We are the creatures who can watch all of this. It's not far from wonder, but it's a little different. We can see all of this. And it's our job to say thank you. That's who we are as human beings. Some people find it real helpful to think of us as being, and again, this is connected to gratitude and wonder, maybe consciousness is our purpose. I will confess to not finding that quite as resonant, but I know other people do find that, is this idea of attention or consciousness. Perhaps that's who we are meant to be, and how we are meant to be. So I think it helps to sort of figure out what for you feels right when you are in the center of yourself. Which of these ideas? What are you for? And where do you feel that activated? Doing what? Do you help further that purpose? I don't think that all of us find our vocation tied to our work for pay. And that's tricky, because again, so much when if you go to a party, somebody says, well, what do? They mean, what do you get paid to do? And some of us don't get paid for everything we do, or we don't get paid for the most important things we do, or we don't get paid for anything we do. That doesn't mean we're not here doing something important. And it's wonderful when those things do align and they work together well. And it is equally wonderful, potentially, when they don't, or when the thing we do doesn't define how we do it, how we show up. You can be a lab tech who shows up with love for everyone. Or here, I hate getting blood drawn. I absolutely hate getting blood drawn. It can make all the difference in the world to whether or not I faint when I get blood drawn, based on the person who is drawing the blood. And it's partly skill, and it's partly whether I feel safe with them. It's an intangible something. We could call it love, and that would be not untrue. But it has something to do with how they show up as a person to do that job that I think is more about vocation than the skill set of handling the needles and the computer and getting things sent off properly labeled to the lab. For someone else, the vocation might be about all those skills. It's really different for everyone. So if you did want to maybe think a little bit about vocation or explore a little bit, and I really, really want to be clear, it's not about finding the one true thing you're supposed to do in your life, because for many of us that doesn't exist. It's different things at different stages or even different weeks. But you might try searching for clues to what calls you when you're at the center of your being. And I keep sort of pointing here. It's somewhere in your gut. You know, our guts have a lot of neurons too, just like our hearts and our brains. And somehow when your gut and your heart and your brain are all sort of together and not fighting with each other, where are you? What are you doing? Yeah, think about that. Why is that working for you? Can you do more of it? Or maybe look for what it is you cannot not do. This has become classic, I think, for a lot of people discerning calls to ministry. We all tell each other, you really don't want to be a minister unless you just can't not do it. and there's a certain truth to that. A lot of people I know, especially those of us who've come to ministry later in our lives, it's like, yeah, I tried a lot of other things, and this is what I'm supposed to be doing. So what is it that you cannot not do? Because your skill set, your interests, your soul, if you will, your spirit needs that. Some people need to do art or need to make music. You probably have lots of these things. So, you know, don't feel like it's a single thing you need to find. I also, you know, I want to encourage you also to pay attention to the rest of the things you'd sometimes rather not do. I could easily not ever scrub another toilet. Nonetheless, it's a part of the world in which I live that needs attention. So go and see, what are you not paying attention to? What work have you been undervaluing or maybe just flat out not experiencing? And maybe think about that. Try doing a few of those things. Empty the dishwasher if you're not the person in your house who usually does it. Maybe just figure out who makes the coffee. We're all going to go have coffee in a few minutes. Who makes the coffee? Maybe find them and say thank you. You know, just practice valuing that labor. Somebody's going to put all these chairs away later too, and the flags. You know, lots of work happens for us to show up and live our lives, and especially our lives in community. You might also just be quiet for a little while. We live so much from the outside in, as Parker Palmer puts it, and we have to. I don't want to say don't do that. Don't ever pay attention to the outside. We couldn't be human beings if we weren't socialized. We learn originally from the outside in always, and it's always a balance between outside and inside. But sometimes being quiet, finding ways to be quiet, working in the garden, walking in the woods, sitting still, coming to church. These are ways sometimes to tap into connection to something deep internal to you. And finally, I want you to just pay attention. I want to invite you to pay attention to what brings joy, what makes you feel connected to the sacred. Because I really do believe that there is holiness, or the potential for holiness, in everything, in all people, in all of creation, in each and every individual, and in every group. And this is something I meant to say. I think I hinted at it. I didn't quite say. I don't think just individuals have vocations. I think groups have vocations. I think congregations are always trying to figure out, who are we in this community? Who are we being called to be? And that's a matter of choosing. You know, who do we choose to go out and be? And I know y'all have those kinds of conversations frequently, especially in your committees. And but who are you supposed to be? And small churches have their vocations. Big churches have different vocations. But we, all of that is potentially holy. And no work is wasted, I think. So I want to leave you, finally, with just a little snippet from Adrienne Marie Brown, because I just love her. So let this be your sending forth. This is from Emergent Strategy. We are going further, past reform to wonder. This requires comprehension that cannot fit in words. Out beyond our children, beyond the end of time, there is a ceaseless cycle, a fractal of sublime, and we come to create it, to soil our hands and faces, loving, loving, loving ourselves and all our places. May it be so. May we be so.